We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Now with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Well, hi again, everyone. I am 1010 Wins Sports Director Mark Rene. This is On the Mark, and we are back in the reading room today with Mr. Met. No, it's not the actual Mr. Met. I think, like the vast majority of mascots, he's actually not allowed to talk. But the man who wrote a book called Mr. Met, he is the New York Mets former media relations guru who is currently the head of alumni relations for the Amazons. Jay Horowitz is with us. Hey, Jay, how are you?
And thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Yeah, how have you been passing the time during this
pandemic? Going for a walk every day, do some reading, watch TV, you know, just trying not to sit around eating cookies all day, you know? But, yeah, just try to, you know, keep up with the current events and, you know, I go for a walk by a park, put my mask on, and, you know, just try to do the right thing. And hopefully just whatever, with all the new stuff coming in and, the protests and everything, hopefully some point we'll get back to normal.
Yeah, how strange is it for you? I mean, this is the first season that you're not, you know, part of baseball yet. Work stoppages, but it's, you know, this is 5 decades you've been at this.
I went to spring training for 2 days. I brought Mike Campton and Glennon Rush down with me, it was part of the alumni program. And then about a week or two after that, a little chaos started and it hasn't stopped since, you know, but it's different for me. You know, I mean, I'm usually, you know, on the go and, you know, working 15, 16 hours a day. And, it's kind of different being at home, but like everybody's in the same boat now. So just trying to make the best of it.
Yeah. The book is called officially Mr. Met, How a Sports Mad Kid from Jersey Became Like Family to Generations of Big Leaguers. And Jay, my first question, even before I sat down to read the book, is how long has this thing been percolating inside of you?
Well, it really not that long, to be honest with you, Mark. I'm going to be 75 in August, you know. Been doing this over 40 years. I really wasn't thinking of writing the book. And then, you know, the more and more I thought about it, I've always been able to make people laugh. I have a lot of funny stories. I said, why don't I put it down in paper? You know, so it took about a year and a half. And a couple of reasons why I wanted to write the book. And I know you said you read the book. I was born with an eye deformity. You know, when my mother was pregnant with me, she got German measles. I was born with glaucoma, blind in my right eye. And I was always embarrassed to say that I was blind in my right eye. I said, well, I can't see only a little bit. I couldn't see at all. And then when I was about 12 or 13, the doctors were concerned that glaucoma would spread to the other eye. So I had a glass eye put in when I was 13, and I just never really told anybody that. So listen, you know, my days of modeling on GQ are over with. Maybe when I do a book, I can get a message out to kids who are born not perfect. They can make something of their lives, you know, and that was one of the reasons. Another thing is wanted to have a chapter to pay tribute to Shannon Ford, who worked with me and unfortunately died of breast cancer, you know, in 2016. I didn't want her legacy go untold and, you know, let the people know what she was about, or how much of a fighter she was and what she did and, you know, how much she meant to me and to the Mets. So those were a couple of reasons why I wanted to write the book, Mark.
You know, it's funny. I've had this thought in my mind for years, and she worked for you for over 20. Shannon was really the daughter you never had.
Yeah.
And I know you addressed that in the book, but it started that chapter, the final chapter, chapter 20, sort of started where it almost appeared to be a dynamic of either a sister or a spouse, but then it you know, you clarified it toward the end of that chapter that she really was the daughter you never had.
Yeah, I just admire her so much, the way she fought. You know, she died 44, much too young to die, two young kids, and she you know, struck the balance. She was a mother. She was dedicated to the Mets, and you know, it was kind of remarkable. When she passed away in 2016, nine major league teams, that's nine, held a moment of silence for her. And if you go in Little Ferry, there's a field that MLB built in her honor, Shannon Dorton Ford Field, where high schools and colleges could play for her memory. So that's a pretty good legacy to have, you know, when so many people care. And she just transcended sports. She was able to do the balance of you know, the players loved her, the front office loved her, and the media loved her. And it's really hard for somebody in the PR profession to have that kind of love that transcends all the different vehicles. But she was able to strike that balance. I never really found anyone say a bad word about her. That's why I wanted to, you know, put it down in paper, and hopefully, you know, girls who read this could read, you know, you can make something of your career in baseball, you know, just like Shannon did.
Yeah. Hey, before we move on to other things, are you still in touch with John and Nikki and Kendall, her husband and kids?
I kind of really speak more with her mom and dad, you know, Debbie and Mike. You know, before this started, we used to have dinner at least a couple times a year and stay in touch. And, you know, I'm kind of more that, and, you know, I'm really in touch with her mother and father more.
Okay. So I'm curious to know, because you've had so many stories that must have compiled in different corners of your brain for the 40 plus years. How did you decide what ultimately got into the book and what didn't?
Well, remember, first thing, I wasn't going to hurt anybody. Listen, I've been around, like I said, a while, and any of the stuff that, you know, that people didn't know, I was never going to you know, cross the boundaries of the locker room. You know, like, you know, people came asking me, like, what really happened on the plane ride back from Houston after the playoffs? Not going to go that way. I just wanted to do a feel-good book to make people laugh and, you know, to talk about the good things and, you know, kind of keep stuff that wasn't all that great, kind of keep it to myself. It wasn't going to be that kind of a book. You write the kind of a book and you say something bad about somebody, or and then what's the point of that? You know, it just, you sever relationships, you sever ties. And I just wasn't going to do that way. You know, I wanted to just think of all the good things that happened and, you know, in the relationships, like with Dwight and Gary Carter and Keith and, you know, Joe Torre, my first manager that I worked with, Terry Collins, my last manager. So there were enough good things to make the book work more.
Jay, if you can think of any one story that ultimately got left on the cutting room floor that didn't get into the book, is there anything?
Let me see. Is there one story that got most of them, you know, most of them got, you know, get into the book. My mind is, I'm just trying to, I can't, you know, I'm just trying to think of, I'm really, most of the stuff really got into the book, Mark, you know?
Yeah, you really did play all the hits too. You know, you covered the Joe Torre era, obviously, and everything that led up to ultimately Davey Johnson and the 86 run. I'm curious to know, and I don't know if you're going to answer this, because, you know, of all the years I've known you, and you seem, and again, you know, you said you didn't want to hurt anybody, and I don't know that this would be hurtful, and you did sort of allude to it in the book, but I wanted to ask it to you this way. All those years you reported to the clubhouse and dealt with players and media people and broadcasters and ownership and management, who's the one person you couldn't wait to see every day when you got to the office?
You know, I could have written all the track play on me through the year. Probably one of my close friends in baseball now. Johnny always taught me and said, if the boys don't like you, they're not going to screw with you. And I guess they must have liked me a little bit, because for 30-plus years, they screwed with me. And my best Johnny Franco story, we're in the old Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles. Johnny comes up with the idea of he unscrewed a horse head from the lobby of the hotel, got the keys to my room, put the horse head under my covers, put ketchup on my pillows, shut the lights off. I walked into the room. I thought I was going to have a freaking heart attack. You know, the guys were outside laughing. But you know what? I just learned through the years, Mark, you got to be able to laugh at yourself. And I was able to do that. And that's how I got through the 40 years. But Johnny, you know, helped me get through what it was like to be in the major league locker room. And really, I owe really a lot of gratitude to Joe Torre, my first manager. You know, I was like a 34-year-old kid coming out of college, didn't know what it was like to be the clubhouse. Joe took me under his wing, introduced me to all his friends, to George Brett, to Pete Rose, to Reggie Jackson. Anytime we went to another town, Joe brought me over. Hey, guys, here's our new kid PR director. And on our first road trip to Montreal, Joe took me to a tie shop in St. Catherine Street. He bought me 7 of the ugliest ties, the big fat tie, and I had to wear them for 7 straight days. But I mean, he taught me what it was like to be in the major leagues. And, you know, I still talk to Joe a lot. He's a good friend. And anytime, you know, going back to Shannon for a second, anytime we had some charity stuff or fundraisers for her, he was always involved and always did his part. And I'm really internally grateful to Joe for all he helped me get started in my job.
You had so many characters as far as managers and bosses and the players who went through over the 40 plus years that you've been involved with this team. It really is remarkable that you were able to cull this down into, you know, about 250 pages. I don't know, you know, to me, if I thought Jay Horowitz was going to write a book, and I want to make sure that everybody understands the name's Horowitz, not Horowitz. And I know that's been a pet peeve of yours with the extra O.
Yeah, they always put the extra O. Somebody, Horowitz, I think, is a matzo factory. He made matzo. I love matzo. I didn't make it, though. I like to eat it.
Yeah. It really is remarkable that you were able to cull this down. And really, I mean, you covered so much ground, too.
Well, I had chapters in the book to, you know, to Joe Torre, Willie Reina, Terry Vic Collins, Bobby Valentine, you know, the 9/11 chapter, my early years, the thing when I wrote the book, I wanted to make sure I didn't forget about the people who meant to me, you know, so much to me in my life. One quick story, people probably know who he was. Jimmy Plummer worked for the Mets for close to 30 years, more than 30 years. He died of a heart attack. And before the summer, before we moved to the Citi Field, the best practical joker I've ever met, Jimmy and I used to go to the Knick games a lot. I never could hold the ticket. So this is what we used to do. We used to go sit down, and he used to go get popcorn. And I never had the tickets. He used to have an usher come back to my seat, answer my ticket. And more than once, he had me evicted from the seat because I hadn't had a ticket. But that's the kind of guy Plum was, the best guy ever. And I'm just, we have a room dedicated at Citi Field called the Plum Room where the anthem singers and the first ball throwers meet. But, you know, really, he was just, he was a minor league manager in Marion, Virginia. Just a great, great guy. And one of the people behind the scenes that a lot of Met fans probably didn't meet, but a lot of great work in charities and just a remarkable guy. He was proud to have been my friend.
And Jay, before you got to the Mets, you had been the longtime sports information director for Fairleigh Dickinson. And I'm wondering, when you started in 1980, how much different did you find your job with the Mets than it was at FDU?
Well, it was kind of a little similar in one respect. When Mets hired me, they weren't a very good team. You know, I had actually turned the job down. A friend of mine, Mike Cohn, used to be the SID in Manhattan, got me a job with Tony Kubek and Joe Garagiola to be the staff guy. And make a long story short, somebody offered me a job. I took the job, and he hired me because I'm offbeat. I'm not the normal PR guy. I didn't do stats. You know, I existed at Fairleigh Dickinson promoting a 43-year-old priest who played hockey, 47-year-old freshman football player, a one-armed fencer. We had an Arab and Israeli goalie on the same soccer team. And they wanted an offbeat guy who would kind of think in a different direction. So my first year with the Mets, I promoted stories like Doug Flynn. He was a country and western singer. He sang with the Oak Ridge Boys. Lee Mazzilli was a speed skater. Joey Youngblood used to hunt with bows and arrows. Until you know, until we got, until really the turning point really came in May of 83 when we brought Darryl Strawberry up. And that, you know, and then 2 months later, we got Keith Hernandez. Then we go to 84 when it really turned. You know, David Johnson's there, Doc Gooden's there, Ron Darling's there. So but the first couple of years, I was kind of doing the same things with the Mets that I did at Fairleigh Dickinson, looking for the human interest kind of stories.
Hey, people ask me all the time as a radio sports update guy, how my job has changed over the years because of the technology and the introduction and explosion, really, of social media. How did your job change over the 40 years?
Well, it was when I first started, I used to write press releases talking about trades. Now everything is on the internet. Everything is with a camera. You know, I mean, players have to be so much on guard now. We had these press seminars in the last couple of years that I was there. You know, be aware who you go up on an elevator with, who you eat in a restaurant with. And look at when Michael Phelps got caught on camera doing some stuff. You just got to be so much more aware of what goes on. And right now, the PR guy doesn't really release any information anymore. It comes from the agents, the players themselves, the tweeting, the Instagram, all the other stuff. That's the thing. It's just a different atmosphere, Mark, you know, than when I started.
So in the last couple of years, you have transitioned into the vice president of alumni relations.
Right.
And your first season last year was the 50th anniversary of the Miracle Mets. So obviously you had a lot planned out well ahead of time. We knew the 50th anniversary was coming up.
Yeah.
You did a great job bringing former players back. The amazing weekend was honestly, it was perfect. It could not have been, the only thing better would have been, you know, a few more wins that weekend. How different was it for you to move out of the media relations department and into alumni relations?
Honestly, Mark, I didn't like it when what happens was the summer of 18, Jeff Wilpon called me to the office and said, listen, do you want to try something different? He said, you know, we really don't have a great relationship with a lot of the alumni. You work with a lot of them. You want to transition to another role. I said, Jeff, honestly, I like to travel. I like the camaraderie of the clubhouse. I'd rather stay where I am. You know, and I thought about it for a day. You know, he said, sometimes change is good. I said, all right, let's give it a try. You know, 39 years of travel, doing the same job. And, you know, I mean, it was time for a change. And I really feel like we've done some good in the last two years. I'll give you an instance. You know, Hobie Landreth was the first draft choice in the Mets in 1961. We called him a couple of months ago, and Hobie said, I was the first person from the Mets organization to speak to him in 50 years. So that's what try. You know, we bring the guys back on a home weekend. We brought by guys like Joey Youngblood, you know, Doug Flynn, Butch Husky, you know, not only the super, super, superstars. You know, we want to try and let these guys know we cared, and we wanted to bring them back in the Mets family. And I really feel good about the stuff we've done. You know, the work that Cleon Jones does with helping restore his hometown of Mobile. You know, we were able to draw some publicity for Ed Cranepool. He was able to get a kidney. You know, a lot of good stuff. And these guys, you know, they like the calls. They feel good about themselves now because they know that the people in New York care about them. And so that's, you know, I'm really in a good place in what we're trying to do.
And I know among the things you had planned for this year was a Jerry Kuzman jersey retirement for number 36. Any idea when that might happen?
Probably not this year. Probably not this year. Hopefully next year. But we're just trying to, Jerry was, you know, speaking to the guys, you know, got to know a lot of the 69 guys. And, you know, Tom Seaver is a great pitcher. Nolan Ryan was coming into his own. But until you hear the esteem that the fellow 69 Mets felt for Jerry Kuzman, it really makes me feel good. They will retire his jersey, you know, one day soon. You know, Jerry was kind of like the protector of the staff. It was one series against the Cubs when Bill Hands, a local guy, hit Tommy Agee in the head, tried to hit him twice. And the first batter up, Jerry hit Ron Santo in the wrist to protect his fellow Met players. But all the guys, they loved Seaver and everybody. but there was a special feeling for Jerry Kuzman too.
And he was really, I think, among the most underrated pitchers of his era, you know, even after he left the Mets and went to the Phillies.
No question.
And Mickey was the last one to wear 36, so I think fans would be okay if nobody else wore it and it was retired for
It will be eventually. You know, one thing that Jeff wanted to do is we're going to put more guys in the Mets Hall of Fame. We're going to induct Ron Darling, John Matlack, and Gaudy Alfonso this year, probably to be pushed back to next year. And, you know, after Jerry's numbers, I think we're going to pick up the pace a little bit and retire some more numbers. So we're trying to really get back to, you know, reconnecting with our past more and more.
Jay, is there any chance we get back to old-timers days at Citi Field?
I don't want to say never. But the thing is, Mark, we kind of felt it gotten a little stale. So what we've done is every home weekend, we brought two guys in for the weekend. They did TV interviews. They were on the field side and autographs. They did social media. They walked around the stadium, connected with the fan. We just felt now it was kind of a different look. And so instead of one game, we had really, you know, 15 to 16 weekends of bringing alumni back. And, you know, they really, you know, loved the autograph sessions in the Hall of Fame club. So, you know, I don't want to say never about never, but, you know, if we were going to play this year, probably would have gone back to bringing the guys in, you know, for the weekend to interact with the fans and that kind of stuff.
All right. I don't want to start any trouble. I know you're tight with Pat Hanlon at the Giants, and the Giants have been doing that kind of stuff for years. So whose idea was it first? Did you borrow from him or did he borrow from you?
No, they did it before we did. I mean, we, you know, Pat's the best thing about Pat is I'm a gigantic Giant fan. He's a gigantic Mets fan. So no, they've been doing it for a while. You know, other teams do it too, but I just thought it would be a way that we haven't done it for a while. We did it a little bit at Shea and Citi Field. Now we just extended the program to do it more and more.
There have been teams over the years who've brought in actually other teams' stars. For example, when I was in Milwaukee, actually to see the Mets play a doubleheader in 1998, the Brewers' first year in the National League, I was walking through the concourse at the old Brewers ballpark, and Fergie Jenkins is set up at a table signing autographs.
Really?
I thought it was bizarre.
I was kind of concentrating on our people, but who knows, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it was very strange. But I'm wondering, would the Mets consider doing that? You know, if the Phillies are in town, would you bring in a Mike Schmidt maybe?
I mean, if he was around in the area, you know, but I think our fans are interested in the guys below the headlines, you know, like, you know, I'll give you an example. Like Jack Fisher came. Jack Fisher started the first game at Chase Stadium in 1964. The fans loved him. You know, I think we're more interested in bringing the kind of guy. Steve Henderson was going to come back this year. You know, we're going to bring back Pat Mahomes, whose son is a pretty good football player. People forget that Pat was a pretty good baseball player, too. So I think we'll probably stick more with our guys and not just focus on our star players, the guys who are fan favorites. Like Rico Bronia, kid from Connecticut, came back, and fans loved him. So there's enough people in Mets history that we can draw on, I think the fans would identify with, Mark.
Yeah, and I think it's always great to have the guys, especially the ones that a lot of people don't think of on a regular basis.
Right.
You know, I think back to the era when you started, and even a couple of years before that, when Dougie Flynn and Frank Tavares would lead the league in double plays turned every year. That was maybe some of the highlights right before you got there. That was among the big highlights is, wow, these guys lead the league in double plays. It's only because the Mets pitchers are letting on more base runners than any other team.
Yeah. It almost got me fired. Doug had just won the Gold Glove Award, and he was going to sign a five-year contract. So I convinced Frank Cashin, the GM at the time, to hold a press conference in a country western club in Manhattan. So Doug wears a cowboy hat. I said to Frank, "Could you, why don't you wear a cowboy hat when we sign the contract?" So he did. And unfortunately, just as he was about to take the picture, the hat slid over Frank's head. So the picture of the back page of the Daily News was our GM looking like Elmer Fudd. So the next day, Frank called me to his office. He wasn't too pleased with me. Wasn't too pleased at all.
Yeah, I would imagine. You know, it's a good thing that you didn't have to work with guys with the temperament of George Steinbrenner, because, you know, the Yankees over the course of your career with the Mets went through how many media relations guys?
A lot. You know, that's one thing I'm always thankful for. You know, we've had our ups and downs in this organization, and you know, the Wilpon family never held it against me when things weren't going great. They understood that, you know, the fans want to win, and the Wilpons want to win so badly too. And if things aren't going great, they understood the process of being in New York. And, you know, I could have been probably fired 20 times over.
Okay, so wrapping up, what are your hopes that we actually see baseball? Obviously, well, the players and the owners are locked up in this negotiation.
I'm not really involved with them. I just want to say, as a baseball fan, I'm hopefully things get worked out. I mean, the main thing I'm hoping for is that, you know, the people get healthy, you know, the country, you know, gets, you know, we work things out with our country and things are, you know, better all around. I'm just hoping for a better situation for everybody in America, because right now it's not great right now.
Man, the timing of this book coming out and current events, and I want to just wrap up with one particular current event. Last week, Sean Clancy announced that Foley's won't be reopening, the very famous and extremely welcoming baseball bar. And I know it doesn't fancy itself as strictly a baseball bar, but baseball fans across the country and around the world really have found a home at Foley's over these last couple of decades. And I know you mentioned Sean and Foley's work with helping to raise funds for Shannon's foundation, Hope Shines for Shannon. When you heard the announcement last week from Sean that Foley's wouldn't be reopening, what were your thoughts?
It's really sad, because not only did he work with Shannon's charity, but numerous charities. And Sean Clancy's got the heart of gold. He's got one bad bone in his body. All he wanted to do is help people. He named sandwiches after, you know, again, guys like Joe McEwing and David Wright, you know, and what he did for Shannon. He's really going to be missed. It's a great place. A lot of memorabilia there. But you know, all the work that Sean did on the side for charities is really remarkable. I know in his way, he'll probably try to keep doing it whatever he can. But Sean's a great man, and really very, very sad to see Foley's go by the wayside.
Yeah, and I'm wondering what will happen to all that memorabilia. He's got over 3,000 baseballs. Yeah. He's got jerseys. He's got all kinds of – I mean, there's really – it's a shrine to sports. And I think, you know, to number one, to have to pack all that stuff up and put it in storage even for a little while is just such a process, and it's really a shame that it's come to that, but obviously the economy being what it is, you know, what choice do you have?
Yeah, hey, Mother, can I say one more thing before we go? I feel kind of guilty in talking about my book now, and I, in this time with people out of work and unemployment is X amount of people, so I just hope my message that the people who read the book could laugh a little bit, maybe cry a little bit, and I just, you know, I just hopefully could do some good. And you know, Mets fans, baseball fans might get a kick out of it. And, you know, in this time, hopefully it gives some pleasure to some people. And I just kind of feel a little bit guilty, you know, talking about my book where there's so many other more pressing things going on in the world right now.
Well, I can tell you, we all kind of need a distraction. And if we can't have the actual games to watch, that I read this book from cover to cover, and it really did cover the entire gamut of emotional reaction. You know, we were laughing about the different stories about the managers and the players and the things that happened, you know, 1986, so long ago now, 34 years. I can't believe it's been 34 years since the last championship. But it was so vividly recalled, not only 86, but the Subway Series in 2000, the run to Game 7 against the Cardinals in 2006. And I think we all sort of get, you know, a pit in our stomach thinking about, and you mentioned it, you know, how good Carlos Beltran was that season, and the Mets probably wouldn't even have gotten to Game 7 against the Cardinals if not for Carlos. But, you know, I joke with him all the time that every time I see him, I want to yell, swing the bat.
Yeah.
You should never end a season on a called third strike. It's just so much
we had other chances to win that game too, you know. You know, after Andy made the catch in that game, I said, there's no way in America we're going to lose that game. But, you know, first and second, ninth inning, we don't score. So be it. But Carl's had a great Mets career, and you look at his stats. I mean, he's a, to me, you know, where I know what happened after that, but his playing career is a borderline Hall of Fame career.
Yeah, it's unfortunate the way things had to end.
Right.
His managerial career over before it starts. Right. Tell everybody your impressions of Luis Rojas and becoming a manager.
I met him in spring training. I know through the years he's a decent human guy. He talks from his heart, and I think he's going to be a great guy. I'm really good friends with his brother, Moises Alou. You know, Moises and I go back a long way when he played for the Mets in the early 2000s. And, you know, so I just think he's a decent human being. I like the way he handles the media. He speaks from his heart, and I think he's going to do well in this market.
Yeah, just like the other manager in town, he comes from a baseball family. His dad,
right,
Felipe
Alou. Right, right. And I know Mo, you know, Mo got hurt the years with the Mets, but I think he hit over 300 in 2 years with us. And I speak – Mo works for – the Padres now, but you know, I speak to him a couple of times, and he was actually to come to a game this year to be the alumni guy to visit with Lewis, but it didn't happen. But yeah, I think Lewis would do really well.
Well, Jay, I appreciate your time. The book is fantastic. It is called, as we remind everybody, Mr. Met, How a Sports Mad Kid from Jersey Became Like Family to Generations of Big Leaguers. Jay Horowitz, you are the best that ever was. I mean, you really, you know, on the pantheon of sports information and media relations guys, if there's a Mount Rushmore, you are right on top of that Mount Rushmore. I thank you for your time. Good luck with the book. And I know, you know, I wish we had happier times to talk about it in, but I do appreciate your time. And I really hope I get to see you much sooner than later at Citi Field.
Be safe. Thanks, man. Bye.
That's Jay Horowitz. I'm Mark O'Day, and you're On the Mark.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.